This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Adrian David Chok is the Professor of Pervasive Computing at City University London. He's in Kuala Lumpur to deliver a talk at the TEDx KL conference this Saturday. And pervasive computing is going to be the topic of today's show. What is pervasive computing?
Well, it really means that before computers were basically inside offices or on our desktops, but now we're having a new era of computing where computers are going to be embedded everywhere in our environment. So pervasive really means that the computing becomes pervasive in our physical world. So it's part of our infrastructure, part of our clothes, even part of our bodies.
Is this something that we're seeing happening at the moment? I mean, could you give me an example of pervasive computing in the setting of my everyday life? You know, I drive to work, I'm here. At what point would pervasive computing kind of factor?
Yeah, already we're at the early steps. And, we've gone through three main eras of computing. So in the early ages, it was many people using one computer. That was the kind of the mainframe age. And the next stage of computing was the personal computer age, where one person to one computer. But now, actually, already we have many computers for one person. Most obvious examples is your mobile phone, which is basically a smart computer. Most of us have a smartphone and a tablet. And, most cars now, you can't service it yourself because it's basically got a little microprocessor in there doing everything. And what's going to be the big change is once all these things connect to the internet. So your car is connected to the internet, your fridge is connected to the internet, and your clothes are connected to the internet. Already people wear things like Fitbits and health monitors. And it's only going to be a small step where, your doctor can monitor you 24 hours a day, your health. If every car was connected to internet, you don't need traffic lights anymore. When you get to intersection, one car can speed up, the other car can slow down. Once things talk to each other through the internet, you could eliminate traffic jams, and so there's going to be so many applications. Even something so simple, if your door was connected to the internet, you could see on your smartphone, oh, my front door is open. Why is it open? You get very simple things like that can give you very important information about your life.
You founded and were previously the director of Mixed Reality Lab. What is mixed reality? Are we in the same realm here?
Yes. Basically, mixed reality is the concept of merging the real world and the virtual world. We all know the virtual world. It's the world of computer games and 3D graphics. And it's not, until now, it's been kind of behind the screen. We see it behind the screen of your laptop or your tablet. But once computers are embedded all through our physical world, then the real world and virtual world will merge together. And there's other parts of mixed reality, such as augmented reality, where we can wear head mount displays and we can see the real world, but augmented onto that, we can see the virtual world at the same time. And so what we're seeing is that this merging of physical world and the virtual world into one.
You're now the director of Imagineering Institute at Iskandar Johor. What work do you do there?
It's a new lab. It started in December. I'm director of the lab, and our tagline is invent the future of internet. So we're continuing the work that I've been doing over the past 15 years or so in research in this concept of mixed reality, but we are going to extend it. We're going to have about 80 researchers. So actually we think it's going to be one of the world centers of excellence for all these new concepts of communication through the internet. If you remember the early Star Wars movies, and you saw Princess Leia as a hologram, and when they played chess on the Millennium Falcon, all these robots playing chess, that's going to become real. We're going to have this merging of the virtual reality, robots and sensors and actuators all through our physical world. And that's what we're working on in the Imagineering Institute.
It wasn't too long ago. You know, when it comes to that tagline, inventing the future of the internet, it wasn't too long ago that even understanding the internet felt like something too futuristic for many to grasp. What is the vision you have for the future of the internet? Where is it headed?
Yes. Well, I think the most important thing is already now we communicate so much with our friends and family online, but now it's mainly through, you know, chat or email or social networks. But imagine the future that you can really feel a telepresence through the internet. You can, even if your friend's in New York or London, you can see them in real time in 3D. You can share a meal together. We're working on devices that you can share not just vision, but touch, taste, and smell through the internet. So the internet in the future will have all of our senses, not just audio-visual like today's internet, but including touch, taste, and smell. You could have a dinner with your friend, and you can hug them through the internet. That's going to be the future. There will be almost no difference between the real world and the virtual world, and it's going to be a new kind of telepresence.
Are you worried, though, that would make more people just stay at home and cause fewer, as is, we're hardly calling our friends, you know, we don't really feel the need to go out and see everybody who might already be in our chat group. Are you worried that this would in some ways exacerbate that?
Well, I mean, in my research, we're trying to make technologies that bring people together. So, for example, I worked on things such as the hugging pajama that parents and children can hug each other through the internet. And so, for example, I'm in Kuala Lumpur now, and my daughter's in Johor. So, even if we want to hug each other, we can't because we're physically apart. But through the internet, we can physically be together, almost physically be together. So, I think there'll be two effects. I think, yes, what you said is true. For some people, they might not bother to leave their house. But already we see that even with video games. You see teenagers, they don't leave their room. They're just playing video games almost 24 hours a day. So there is that danger. But I think overall, if you look at society as a whole, it's going to increase communication and allow, you know, a much more sense of presence. Even if your grandmother's in a different country, you can hug your grandmother through the internet, and you can see her in full 3D. And it's not just people, you know, it's, robots also will be part of this future of the internet. So even if you stay in the home, you have robots to keep you company in the house. We'll have humanoid and android robots, which will become our friends in the future.
How far along are we in this process of adding other senses to the internet?
In my laboratory, we've been working on the last few years on integrating touch and taste and smell. And for touch, I would say it's a little bit more advanced because of there's quite a lot of research in the field of what's called haptics, which is the engineering or science of touch, and particularly because of the increase of research into robotics and robotics which are android or humanoid. So they have to be able to feel like humans. And for example, something very simple that humans can do, like pick up an egg, it's actually very difficult for a robot because, you know, it needs very light touch. So there's actually been a lot of work on haptics or touch. Taste and smell are still the very early days. In our laboratory, we've made devices that you can put onto your tongue and stimulate taste without any chemicals, just with electrical signals. The advantage of that, of course, you can send the taste through the internet, which you can't send chemicals through the internet. And we're also working on a new system which will have electrodes inside your nose and be able to stimulate smell using electrical signals. So in the lab, we have successfully made these devices, but still, it's very early stage for commercial products, but one of our collaborators has released a device in Japan called a Senti, and it's a device you can plug into your mobile phone and send smell. So if it's your friend's birthday, you can send her the smell of strawberry or chocolate, as well as a message on the phone.
What senses are the most difficult or complex to send over the internet? Because everything that you're describing, I think touch and smell and taste, they're all very complex experiences.
Yes, yes. I think the most difficult is probably smell, and that is because the way we sense smell is very different from our other senses. So, for example, although sound and vision is very, you know, is very advanced in humans, but basically we're measuring frequencies, so frequency of sound, frequency of light, and this means it's very easy to digitize sound and vision, which is why, you know, now we have digital TV and everything's digital for the audio and vision. But for smell, we have an olfactory bulb, and it has we think it has probably thousands of different receptors, and it's not measuring frequency. It's like a lock and key mechanism. It measures, it senses chemicals which are coming into your nose. That means it's very difficult to digitize because it's, by nature, it's a very analog sense. We still at the very early stages of how we can transmit this through the internet.
I'm speaking today with Adrian Davidchuk, Professor of Pervasive Computing at City University London. We're talking about the Internet of the Future. Up next, we address privacy issues. You're listening to Live and Learn today on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me in the studio, Adrian Davidchuk, Professor of Pervasive Computing at City University London. We've been discussing the Internet of the Future. With earlier you talked about how with the work you've been doing, there's been some headway into being able to send touch and smell and taste through the internet. And then you also said that at the moment, you know, you're still relatively far away from commercial applications. How much will it cost when it finally does hit the market? You know, because obviously it's going to be something that people are going to want to be able to use. They can not just send photos of their food, but tastes and smells to their friends.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the number two category of photos is food.
People can't
photos.
Exactly.
I think number one is pets, I think. But I mean, some early technologies come onto the market. So, for example, the Senti, which is sold in Japan by one of my friends, it's about $20, but it uses chemicals. So the problem is that you have to refill the device. And what we want to do is to make a device which just stimulates the smell or taste with electrical signals, then you don't have to refill, and you can send to the internet. And also you can send to one friend or 100 friends at the same time. That's the beauty of digital. I think with every technology, probably initially it's quite expensive. But what we see is that the time constants of technology becoming cheap is getting shorter and shorter. So it used to take, you know, quite a few years before things would decrease in cost. But now, you know, for example, if you look at high-definition television, it was quite expensive maybe a couple of years ago. Already they're so cheap. So I think the time constant of technology, the cycles are just becoming rapidly shorter. So I think that definitely within the next few years, these technologies will be affordable for the mass market.
When it comes to research that's being done in this field in particular, how much of it is conceptual curiosity and how much of it has to relate directly to real-life applications?
I think when we do this kind of research, it's mainly driven by curiosity, and so my researchers and PhD students that I have in my lab, I tell them what we're trying to do is not just incremental work, because I think companies can do incremental improvements, and what our goal should be is quantum step research, which is really taking like a quantum step, and for that it really should be driven by the curiosity. And I think if we have to think too much about commercial applications, it's very difficult to do very high innovation research. But on the other hand, difficult to predict when they will be commercialized. But if you look, for example, at the iPad, the roots of the iPad go back to 1970s, and Alan Kay at the Park Xerox Lab made a tablet PC, and that was like about mid-1970s, so it really took 20 plus years to become a commercial product. But you know, on the other hand, if they didn't do that, then we wouldn't be where we are today. So I think our job as researchers is to take the real big challenges and be visionaries, be explorers, and try to make something totally new.
In a future where even more of our lives are connected to the internet and everything's just on there, would security and privacy issues be of even greater concern? And how would we be able to educate users to consider that?
Yes. Well, I think this is a big issue, and although there'll be some people who will be very concerned about their privacy, I think the majority of people will find their convenience is so high that they will go along with the default, which is to be. I think technology and internet is driving us to be more and more open, you know, if you look at credit cards, you know, if you can track everyone's where they've been and what they've bought already with credit cards, but most people don't really care about that privacy issue of using a credit card because it's so convenient. And I think that most people will be driven by the technology to be more and more open. Now, of course, I believe within our lifetime we'll be able to directly connect these devices to our brain, so, you know, brain interface. And at that point, what might be a bit dangerous if someone can hack our brain or control our brain. But I think that's still quite a long time away before we have to think about that kind of danger. But in the meantime, I think what we're seeing is society becomes more and more open. I mean, if you look at things like Facebook and Twitter, people are, you know, I mean, people are just being open about almost everything in their lives. And if you look at young people, they don't really have as much concerns about privacy than what maybe my mother's generation had, you know, felt very concerned about privacy. I think young people are changing very much. And in fact, the default is to be more open in the internet society.
Earlier, you talked about how in the future it's going to be perfectly normal for people to be friends with robots, to have robots accompany us. And you've also said that it would be perfectly normal for people to have sex with robots in the internet of the future. Could you elaborate on this? I mean, I think for many people, this is still something that feels in some very... it feels taboo in many ways.
Yes. Well, there's been a great advance in humanoid robot technology, and the main driver has been health and care. So, for example, in countries like Japan, where the government and, you know, industry putting a lot of funding into humanoid robots because they have a rapidly aging population. I think now already 1/4 of the population is above 65, and if you go through the maths, you realize that there's not enough young people to look after the elderly people. So the only real solution is robots in Japan, where they have very, very little immigration. But once you have once you put robot in the home, it has to be human-sized because everything in the home is already designed for humans. The chairs, the beds, the kitchen, it's already designed for humans. We're not going to redesign our home for a robot. So that means the robot has to be designed for human size and human homes. And so the default will be humans will be androids and humanoids, and they will look realistic. Already we feel empathy to non-humans. For example, people love their dog. Children might love their hamster or bird. I think humans have a natural capacity for empathy, not just to humans, but to non-human creatures. So once you have a robot in the house which looks human and which is intelligent, which can speak to you, I think at first we will feel empathy, and then we will feel friendship and even love for robots. So people will fall in love with robots, and if people fall in love with robots, then the next step is they will have sex with the robot. So I think that would be very normal in the future. And, you know, just it wasn't very long ago that in America, white people and black people couldn't, it was illegal to marry each other. But now we would think that's strange to have such a law that white and black people can't marry each other. So I think the norms of society will change rapidly, and we'll think it's quite normal. And a lot of people can't find a partner, so there's a lot of people in this world that find it very difficult to meet a partner, especially in the very busy world where they're maybe we're spending too much time in the office. So having a robot as a partner may be increasing human happiness overall.
Would you still consider a relationship with a robot as a virtual experience, or have we kind of crossed that line if we are talking about something that's occupying the same physical space as us?
Yes, I think that's the important thing, the physicality. And already we see the phenomenon of young people falling in love with a virtual character in a game or, on their Nintendo DS. There was some famous cases of a man in Korea that wanted to marry the virtual character. So already we're seeing the start of these things when the virtual characters are on the screen. But imagine they're in your physical world and you can touch them and they are part of our physical world. I think the intensity of feeling of affection and love will definitely increase. When we have such robots.
Moving on to wearable computers, we have portable computers, as you pointed out, with our smartphones. Wearable computers are now entering the market. What's your opinion on the current state that we have available?
Yes, it's become a very hot area for the tech industry. So, as many people know, there's a lot of these devices, that, like a Fitbit and other health monitoring devices, and people find it very natural to wear something on their wrist to measure their motion, to see how many hours they sleep, what's their heart rate, etc. It's not too much of a big step to see that we can embed these electronics into our clothes, into our shoes, and in the future even inside our body. People might think, I would never put a robot or device into my body, but already people wear pacemakers for the heart, and that's become perfectly normal. Nobody thinks that's strange. So I think initially we'll have compelling applications such as healthcare, but the next stage is even people who are healthy, they just want to monitor their body and even inside their bodies, and then send that data to your doctor, and then there'll be computer programs to monitor for anything which looks like something wrong in your body. But right now it's a very high industry, and another thing which is I think huge impetus is the Apple Watch, because Apple is very good at building ecosystems. So right now you have a lot of little companies making wearable technology, but Apple Watch can bring it all together, because I think the important thing about Apple Watch is that it can connect to all of your devices, and then it connects to your phone. So it's building a personal network. And so I think we're going to see It's a rapidly increasing area, especially now with the introduction of the Apple Watch.
When we talk about how there's some initial resistance to these ideas at the beginning, I would imagine that working in the field that you work in, the resistance is perhaps less than you might experience when you go outside and start talking about, having robot friends, for example. What has the usual reaction been when you kind of go outside of your own field of study and speak to people about this?
Yes. I'm quite often asked to give talks at conferences, which is not related so much to my research field. For example, tomorrow I'm speaking at a conference which is topic is about finance. So I do think it's very important to talk to as many different people as possible, and also different ages, young, middle age, old. You'd be surprised that the resistance is not as high as that we'd imagine. And we did a survey a couple of years ago, and we asked the question, number one is, could you feel love for a robot? And number two is, do you think robot can love you, humans? And, we saw 40-45% of people said yes to both questions. So I think, that... the resistance is not as high as we imagine. And also once they once these things become more and more normal, people's opinions will change. In the US, recently the Supreme Court said that under the Constitution, everyone has a right to be married, even if they're same sex. But that would be unimaginable. We could never, even 5 years ago, that would be unimaginable that the Supreme Court of America would pass such a law. So, things can really change quickly in our society.
You've used the words intelligence and love in relation to robots in the course of our chat. And the thing about intelligence is that it's particularly loaded in this field because obviously, you wonder about sentient intelligence, you wonder about artificial intelligence. What's your take on that in terms of all this, in terms of the robots that we're going to be having accompanying us? When we say intelligent, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about intelligence that we've programmed? Are we talking about intelligence?
Yeah, well, this has been a debate for years and probably going back to early roots of philosophy. My personal opinion is that when we make machines, computers, machines, they're not actually intelligent like humans, but because finally it's a computer program. The main point is that that's more of a philosophical question. In the real world, if you can simulate the intelligence well enough, then it doesn't really matter whether it's actually intelligent or not. There's a famous product which is like a robot seal, which was brought out in Japan, and it really looks like a baby seal and it acts like a baby seal and it makes all the noises of a baby seal. But of course, it's not a baby seal, and we all know that. But when they gave it to the elderly people in the care home, they loved it so much. When they took it away, the elderly were crying. So I think it shows that we don't really need to have actual intelligence as long as we can. If we simulate it well enough, that is enough to trigger our empathy response in our brains.
Adrian is in Kuala Lumpur to deliver a talk at the TEDxKL conference this weekend, August 8th at the Putra Indoor Stadium, Bukit Jalil. His talk is titled Everywhere, Every Sense, Communication. Thanks for coming in today. I've been speaking with Adrian David Chow, Professor of Pervasive Computing at City University London, and we've been discussing the Internet of the Future. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.